past, so we may preserve Mother Earth for ancestors yet to come. We are the land.
This is dedicated to our relatives before us, thousands of years ago, and to the 150 million who were exterminated across the Western Hemisphere in the first 400 years' time, starting in 1492.
To those who have kept their homelands, and to the nations extinct due to mass slaughter, slavery, deportation, and disease unknown to them, and to the ones who are subjected to the same treatment today.
To the ones who survived the relocations and the ones who died along the way. To those who carried on traditions and lived strong among their people. To those who left their communities by force or by choice and for generations no longer know who they are.
To those who search and never find. To those that turn away the so-called non-accepted. To those that bring us together. And to those living outside, keeping touch, the voice for many.
To those that make it back to live and fight the struggles of their people. To those that give up and those who do not care. To those who abuse themselves and others. And those who revive again. To those who are physically, mentally, or spiritually incapable by accident or by birth.
To those who seek strength in our spirituality and ways of life, and those who exploit it, even our own. To those who fall for the lies and join the dividing lines that keep us fighting amongst each other.
To the outsiders who step in, good or bad, and those of us who don't know better. To the leaders and prisoners of war, politics, crime, race, and religion, innocent or guilty.
To the young, the old, the living, and the dead. To our brothers and sisters and all living things across Mother Earth.
And her beauty we've destroyed and denied the honor that the Creator has given each individual.
The truth that lies in our hearts. All my relatives.
The preceding program was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. More audio can be found online at kboo.fm.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors is delighted to invite all KBOO members to the annual membership meeting and Board of Directors elections. The meeting will be held on Saturday, September 17th at 1 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, Portland. A Zoom link and call-in access will be provided to those who are unable to attend in person. This is the opportunity for all members to meet the candidates, get station updates, and make their voices heard. Again, that's KBOO's annual membership meeting and Board of Directors elections, Saturday, September 17th at 1 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/meeting2022.
Hi, this is Dwight Yoakam, and you're listening to KBOO.
Hello, and you are listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350 Climate Action. Our show presents environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame, featuring voices not necessarily heard on mainstream media. Welcome, I am Jessica Aldridge. On today's show, Ethnobotany, Cultural Fire, and Indigenous Stewardship, host Carrie Kim will be interviewing Payum Kawish Elder Richard Bugby, instructor of ethnobotany and ethnoecology at Cuyamaca College through Kumeyaay Community College in San Diego County, California. Richard Bugby is Payum Kawish, otherwise known as Juaneño and Luiseño. Richard is the chair of the board of directors for the Advocates for Indigenous California Language Survival. He was the ethnobotanist for the Traditional Indian Health Program through Riverside San Bernardino Indian Health, providing information on the interactions between traditional plant and pharmaceutical medicines. Richard teaches indigenous material cultures and traditional plant uses of Southern California, and his goal is to use knowledge to serve as a bridge that connects the wisdom of the elders with today's youth. Aloha, this is Carrie Kim. Listeners, mahalo for joining us today to discuss ethnobotany and ethnoecology, perspectives on cultural burning and traditional plant uses with ethnobotanist and ethnoecologist Richard Bugby of the Payam Pachom Nation, who is also connected with various other tribal nations, including the Kumeyaay. We want to thank the Tongva ancestors for their enduring presence, legacy, and stewardship of this area. Our show comes to you from the ancestral lands of the Tongva, and we encourage all listeners to support Native First Nations wherever you live to help them continue their stewardship. Welcome, Richard. We are so honored to have you on the show tonight.
You. Yeah, it's good to be here.
Is there any particular way you would like to open the interview?
I can introduce myself in my language, I guess.
Yes, please.
Miyum Michisui Notung Ipakwishwakika Tachi Notung Richard Babriaka Nom Payankwish Nom Nokiopum Hellhole Canyon.
Thank you. Your entire life has been devoted to the study and teaching of traditional plant uses and indigenous material culture. Could you share why this became your life path?
It actually started with my grandfather. And my grandfather, all my life, never lived very far from me. He was always within a block or two from living from where I lived. Mm-hmm. Even when I got married, I moved into a duplex. And mm-hmm. he had the other side. So.
Oh, nice.
And he used to take me off in these little adventures. He'd show me how to make shelters and how to bows and arrows and how to make bows and arrows and stuff like that. Mm. Not so much medicines and food so much, but more utilitarian type stuff. My grandfather was a cowboy.
Mm.
And cowboys were kind of, with trucks, there wasn't much use for cowboys after trucks came along. The new cows then. Mm-hmm. So he took me out to the desert a lot. Mm-hmm. And taught me a lot about plants and living out in the nature, I guess you would call it.
Mm-hmm.
I have a problem with calling it a wild because there's no, in our languages, there's no such thing as wild.
No separation.
No concept of wild. Our closest concept of wild is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
and so that's the only thing we have is wild is. Right. Is actually the same word as for crazy. And even the word, we do have the Kumeyaays do have a word for wild, but it's actually taken from Hebrew, I guess.
Mm.
It's called gentil. Mm-hmm. And I think it comes from the word Gentile.
Okay.
But so we have no concept of wild. And
it makes perfect sense because there's no separation, whereas here we have, incredible separation from nature. It's something outside of ourselves for the most part for Western.
And you actually live in your house.
You're right.
In the old days, you lived outside your house. You stored things in your house.
Right.
You went in your house during rainy weather, but you lived outside.
Right.
you know, you lived underneath a Ramada. You like that, though.
Mm-hmm.
Fresh going through.
And it feels so much better when we do. I mean, I think of that from when I was down in the Amazon, and, you know, it's like four walls open and just a roof overhead, and that's it. The most basic structure that's meant to dissolve back into nature, not stand for hundreds of years.
And I have a picture of seven Kumeyaay ladies, and it was taken in 1892.
Mm-hmm.
And the youngest one of these seven is 105.
Wow.
And there's a lady there that's 112. Mm-hmm. And she's standing straight up with her hands on her hips.
Amazing.
And there's two ladies, one's 126, mm-hmm. and the other one's 128.
Amazing.
And those are the only two that needed canes. And that's because not only did they eat healthy,
mm-hmm.
eat healthy foods, could eat acorn, wild meats. Wild meats are very healthy,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to domestic meats.
Right.
And they had to go gather their food, which was exercise.
Water.
Being an elder, they probably got a lot of it delivered to them. And so they lived to be very old.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought about how the education system worked. How did we educate ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we educated, you know, through our family, and like I did through my grandfather.
Right.
And that was the traditional way, is through your grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
But if your grandparents are living to be 125, you're going to have like great, great, great grandparents there.
Right.
And that's a lot of grandparents, because you have four grandparents. You have great grandparents.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You have 16 great, great grandparents.
Wow.
And so for every student, there was 40 teachers.
Amazing.
That loved you and cared for you and wanted the best for you.
Mm-hmm.
And opposed to each teacher having 40 students that were kind of, yeah, you know, they're there, and but they're gone, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's not a personal.
In the traditional way, the students never leave, you know. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's almost 24 hours a day, school.
Yeah, you're living together. And they're all close, whereas now everyone is living apart from most of their relatives, I would say, you know, far from, for the average person. They're not living in the same vicinity of, especially not multiple sets of grandparents.
Yeah, and the ceremonies that go with it, like our puberty ceremonies that really separated being youth and being an adult and your responsibilities, and also your knowing what you're going to be in life. There's no doubts. This is the direction. You're going to be a singer, you're going to be a dancer, you're going to be a medicine person or a plant person or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You knew by that age. And then you had all those 40 teachers like say, oh, I know about this plant, or I know about, you know, I'll teach.
But you were guided to find that path, right? Mm-hmm. That was just part of the tradition.
Yeah, yeah.
You had assistance in finding that path, you know, distilling it all down. You know, you speak highly of your Kumeyaay mentor, Jane Dumas.
Yes.
How did she become your mentor around traditional plants in the Kumeyaay language?
I actually was close to her sister, Jenny.
Mm-hmm.
And Jenny's actually the lady that gave me my name. She kind of gave me a name. But we would go out, and Jenny would say, talk about her weeds.
Mm-hmm.
and I would listen to what she had to say, and I also would listen to a lot of people would come up and ask her questions afterwards, but mm-hmm. I never would. I would always just listen.
Mm-hmm.
And after about a year or so or two, she goes, "Oh, you're interested in plants?" I go, "Yeah." She goes, "You want to go to my mom's gathering place and help me gather?"
Uh-huh.
And then she gave me my first lesson.
Well, you studied with her for like three continuous decades, right?
Yeah, 35 years, yeah.
Amazing. To have
probably in my 30s, you know.
Mm-hmm. But then the language, did that come naturally as part of your learning with her, that was just...
That happened because, first of all, she would talk about plants, but no one knew what she's talking about.
Like, you mean the name?
She'd say, "Oh, talking. She talk about fifth thigh." No one knew what fifth thigh was, mm-hmm. you know. And or she talk about lacy sage.
Right.
No one knew what lacy sage was, and she talk about these plants. And what she had to say was really interesting. People weren't quite sure what plant she was talking about. Sometimes she'd bring an example and then they could kind of figure it out. But so I went back to school and took a bunch of botany.
Mm-hmm.
So I can say, oh, Pithai is Salvia apiana.
Did other people do the same, or was that kind of just you had that feeling that you needed to do that?
I had the feeling I had to do that. I had to explain. Because by that time we were both talking about, I was talking about lacy sage and I was talking about fifth thigh, and I needed to do it for myself.
You know, people say that our cosmological worldviews are shaped fundamentally by language. And I wonder, do you feel that the reclaiming of language by indigenous peoples is essential to transforming our world from materialism to a nature-connected life?
Oh yeah, especially indigenous languages, because our languages are reflections of our environment.
Mm-hmm.
But that it's reflections of our environment, that the way it used to be, not mm-hmm. apartments and streets.
Mm-hmm. And concrete, right.
Concrete, yeah. That's one of the things we talked about, keeping our house clean. Mm-hmm. Well, the outside was our house and we had to keep it clean. Right. I'm kind of doing that with my little yard here, and keeping it native. And it's kind of, I'm watching little things happen that I didn't think would happen. Someone really dug out all the mustard out of here.
Oh, right.
They dug it deep.
Uh-huh.
And they pulled a lot of soil up when they pulled out the root.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed the quail are coming in here like 4 or 5 times a day, because we got into the seed bank.
Yeah,
and I think what they got it is into the mustard seed bank, the non-native seed bank.
Mm-hmm.
And if I think the more the quail eat, the less they'll grow next year.
What were some of the ways that learning the Kumeyaay language has shaped who you are and how you see?
Well, one of the things when I first heard the language, I could hear the flow of it.
Mm.
There's a flow, there's a rhythm to it. One of the organizations I belong to is Advocates for Indigenous California Language Survival, and we revive languages throughout California. And one of our more successful ones in Southern California was the Kumeyaay. It went from like 25 speakers to maybe 100 speakers.
And over how much time did that take to get to that kind of density of, you know, people who spoke the language?
Not much time at all.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'd say no more than 20 years.
Mm.
And then with the Tongva, the Chumash, and the Hachmam, they had zero speakers, and now they have, I don't quite know how many they have now, but they have several speakers now. And they, what they did was they went through our program called Breath of Life, and they went through the archives and listened to the tapes up at UC Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And worked with a linguist,
right,
to kind of piece the language together. Mm-hmm. And then they do a little project in the language, and it just started with that. Actually, the Tongva language, the first thing that was spoken for probably 100 years was they did the hokey pokey. Because it was simple, it was left, right.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Me out of
How many different languages are in California itself that have been, you know, brought back in this way? Has it been quite a lot?
Yeah, through the breath of life it's probably been 20 years. So yeah, and it just focuses on we have that when I say 20 years, it's every other year. So, so that means it's, there was 10 of them.
Okay.
And then the alternate years is language is life, and that's for people that have speakers are not for everybody is concerned with language.
Right. But the people are only indigenous peoples who are learning the language, right? They're not people who are not of that particular nation.
We try to have it so that it's people from that tribe. Mm-hmm. But if the language is really endangered and the tribe says
it's okay for
you want this person to learn because
right
they knew so and so, or, you know, they requested, right. Then, you know, we're not going to tell the tribe what.
Right. Thing exactly. Well, it's definitely an issue, isn't it? I mean, the carrying on of traditional wisdom and language, you need people who are actually carrying that in their being, you know. And I just wanna, yeah,
and when I see that in the young people, when I mean young people like their late teens or early 20s, they become more active in their culture, and they have this pride that they didn't have before they knew the language.
Right, because no one encouraged them to speak,
and
right?
They speak the language to each other now. When they greet each other, so it's a really good thing.
I think it's like what you said, the pride, you know, and pride in the form of like a dignity, you know, in connecting with our ancestry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of people dream in their language before they even learn it, and then learn the language and figure out what they're dreaming about.
Right, going backwards here in retrospect. Yeah. Richard, we're going to take a break right here and we'll come back and speak a bit more about elders and traditional wisdom.
Okay.
Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying Eco Justice Radio. Stay connected by subscribing to Eco Justice Radio on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows and guests and get connected with us on social media. Today, you are listening to Ethnobotany, Cultural Fire, and Indigenous Stewardship with host Carrie Kim and guest Payumkawish Elder Richard Bugbee, instructor of ethnobotany and ethnoecology at Cuyamaca College through Kumeyaay Community College in San Diego County, California.
So, you know, many of us know that these days we may have more elderly than we have elders, and that many gifted and wise elders, ones who are carrying a lot of their traditional wisdom, have entered the spirit realm. And I wonder, what are your thoughts about the passing on of intergenerational wisdom, especially against the backdrop of technology, where youth may be more drawn in that direction than they are to their traditional cultures? You know, what do you feel is the best way to encourage youth back? Is it the language itself, first beginning with that, in order that they eventually will become elders?
I think the language has a lot to do with it. Because once they get into the language, they get so immersed into the culture. And then it also, when you learn the language, there's certain things you start to understand that you didn't understand in English. You're kind of thinking in a different perspective. And I can't think of an example, but there's just certain things that don't make sense in English, but make perfect sense when you speak it in the language.
Right. Or things don't translate. I mean, do you feel that?
And the languages are so different. The between the Kumeyaay and the Payumkawish, or the Kumeyaay language is actually called Ipaya or Tipaya, and the Luseno language is actually called Chamtale. But in the Luseno language, it's just so different from the Kumeyaay language. It's just Kumeyaay has very little grammar in it. Luseno it's all about grammar.
And you also speak the language of the Payumkawish or the Luiseno as well?
I understand it pretty well. I understand Tongva pretty well too. Because I lived in Topanga. There was nobody to talk to in Topanga except my wolf dogs and the animals around there. But since I was in Tongva territory, it was only right that I talked to them in Tongva. Started talking to him in Tongva, but still my wolf's commands for some reason were in Kumeyaay. And anybody that wanted to talk to my dog at the no Kumeyaay or didn't get much of a reaction.
You've spoken about the need to further or develop a cultural burning network in Southern California, knowing that much more has been done in Northern California around cultural burning and bringing that back. What is your role with the intertribal fire stewardship, and how do you envision that this can be propagated down here, this wisdom or these practices to be brought back?
It's kind of accepted up north. Margot Robbins, she's Yurok, and she has this really nice video about doing cultural burns.
Mm-hmm.
And down here, people are very afraid of fire. It's like a scary word.
Right.
But I think if we can get people to follow fires, follow the devastating fires so they don't build up those, at least those areas that burnt, don't build up fuel like they do.
Mm-hmm.
There I went. I hate using the word fuel.
Right.
Because they're plants.
Right.
They're living beings. They're not just fuel. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's actually part of the difference between a control burn and a cultural burn. A control burn sees acreage and fuel, and they want to decrease the amount of fuel on the most amount of acreage.
Mm-hmm.
On a cultural burn, you're thinking about plant communities, mm-hmm. and making that plant community healthy with a burn.
Right.
But the secondary thing is it causes small fire breaks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not devastating ones like the control ones are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of like...
And healthy plant communities don't burn.
Well, you had said before in another call that we had together about instead of land management, it's relationships with the land. And I think that kind of depicts the same kind of difference of this almost a dissociated way of talking, or like a clinical way of talking about nature, instead of as our relatives, as our ancestors, as living entities and beings. It's very different. And I think your use of the word relationship is really how we should be speaking, you know, not management. That word has always just stuck me. I don't know. I find it very disturbing.
Yeah, I did too. But that's what it came out as, is Indian land management.
Right.
Indian land management.
And sounds like a weird bureaucracy, and just it's control. It sounds like control. That's what it sounds like.
And I know the people that put those out, but they meant no harm, and that's just the way they think.
Yeah, but it's that kind
it's not a management thing, it's a relationship. Because whatever we did to the plants, whatever benefit we gave to the plants, or they gave it back to us, or whatever they gave to us, we gave it back to them. And it was just beneficial, you know. And we'll watch like the animals that chew up, that eat the plants.
Mm-hmm.
Our native animals are browsers. They trim the plants. They stimulate growth.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not grazers, which, you know, destroy the growth.
Right. You know, could you explain what the role of an ethnobotanist is?
I don't know. I was just a plant guy, and I hope it's the one of the things people like to put in gardens, because I don't know why they just I have this, all this stuff outside right now, but they want to put in gardens, and then they want to put in ethnobotanical gardens.
Mm-hmm.
An ethnobotanical garden means you gather in it. You take the benefit from those plants and in return benefit those plants. And that's ethnobotanical garden. What they want to do is they want to grow the plant and say, oh, look, that's a pretty plant there, and just look at it.
Right.
Oh, that's not an ethnobotanical garden. That's a botanical garden.
There's
no ethno in it.
There's no sort of relationship that's happening.
There's no relationship going, yes.
In that way, like where you're harvesting and then you grow, and it's a different kind of relationship.
And it's not always just a physical one, it's a spiritual one, you know. we have songs for gathering different, mm-hmm. you know, different mm-hmm. plants. There's ceremony for this. And then what plants are used in ceremony.
Mm-hmm. And then I'm sure you have different growing traditions. I mean, do you have growing traditions around the moon cycles and, you know, things yeah. like that, that are very specific?
Seasons? Most plants are on a lunar cycle. Mm-hmm. Some are on a solar cycle, like deer grass for the stalks for the basketry. You gather mm-hmm. those in the fall. Mm-hmm. And some of them things you gather in the fall, some willows and stuff. Mm-hmm. But most everything's on the full moon. Mm-hmm. And then with non-native plants, it's usually after a rain.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care about the thunder moon. They don't belong there anyway.
What is your feeling being ethnobotanist? What is your feeling around this conversation around native, non-native, and as far as plants are concerned? You know, because that can become very divisive also, where people become very extreme in their views about everything you see that's non-native. And, you know, I wonder what you have to say about that.
My teacher, Jane, she had no concept of native, non-native. She mm-hmm. knew what her mom used and what her mom didn't use. Like Ikukush is eucalyptus.
Mm-hmm.
It means a tall tree, but
yeah. And, okay.
What was another one? Mustas, which is the most invasive plant we have, which is mustard.
Uh huh.
But they love it. The elders love that plant. I mean, she one time asked the ranger if she could have some mustard that was growing on the hillside. He said, "Yeah, take all you want." She couldn't believe it. He's so generous.
Were they eating it? I mean, is that what they were doing with that?
Oh, yeah. What she did was she would parboil it and put it in serving-sized baggies and freeze them and pull them out. And she had her own frozen foods section.
Now, I wanted to ask you, there's been a lot of consternation over the word science, especially the last couple years. And I feel that science has become divorced from spirituality over human time. Do you feel that these are mutually exclusive terms? And does science have a role in indigenous life ways?
Well, to me, science is trial and error
mm-hmm.
until they get it right. But we've done all that trial and error already.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we got it right. We don't. You know, if you take a plant and you have to cook it three times to get the bitterness out, you must know what you're doing, because I would have gave up after the first time.
mm-hmm.
So I do think they can work hand in hand, though.
I think the problem is when we make science separate from spirituality instead of it being something spiritual as well. You know, whether you could call it alchemy, and all of a sudden that changes the way we think about it. What's the difference really between something alchemical or something, you know, or science? You know, we've made it these terms. And I don't know. I mean, I guess also at a certain point, the way we think about science, when does science or academic kind of learning, that becomes a hindrance to learning, right? So there's some kind of a fine balance too.
You know, because I co-teach with a scientist
mm-hmm.
and she's an actual botanist. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when she's talking, I go, "Oh yeah, that's in our creation story."
Uh-huh.
You know, like talk about basic life, and I go, "What is pond scum?" She goes, "Oh, that's algae." I go, "Yeah, that's in our creation story." It was one of the first things created. Mm-hmm. You know, it makes sense. Well, it's one of the first life forms, though.
Yes. What would you like to say about fire and the notion of droughts in California? You know, what do you say are the common misperceptions and the truths about both?
You know, I had my PowerPoint and for a long time it says the results of fire, and one of it said increases water. And I go, "Oh, that must be a mistake." But it's not a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
It's what they found, one of the guys I work with, State Parks Advisory Group, Ron Good, Okay. Anyway, they did these little burns in their in Mono Country, southern Miwa, southern Sierras, and they noticed that after the burns, native grasses started, or native plants started coming up, and the water table started rising, and the little creek started flowing again. And what it was the plants after the burn. The plants that got burned away were plants that were sucking water up. And the plants that got replaced were plants that were holding water in their roots. And so it was actually pulling the water table up. Replenishing your aquifer is a pretty good way to help with a drought, you know.
Nature's brilliance, right? So it's already built in.
Yeah, we never start our water on the outside. We always started on the inside and had all these cool springs that would bubble it up to us.
Now, you mentioned being a former member of the Native American Council for California State Parks, and you know, I was wondering if you could speak about how this council interacted with the state parks and what kind of impact it had on how they're run. We know that the kind of sordid history of state parks, that many were, you know, they're on stolen land, they're involved a lot of forced displacement of indigenous peoples, but being on that council, what was the aim of the council and what was achieved, do you feel?
It was dissolved and Wilson became governor. He dissolved all ethnic groups, advisory groups. But when it was still there, we were a advisor to the director himself. And there was six of us. Two from the north, two from the center, and two from the south.
Right.
And no, there was three of us when I moved. We went to the center. We were pretty effective. One of the ladies was Vivian Hailstone, and her and I put together a basket weaver's gathering permit for state parks, where elders can actually have young people gather for them. And it's a really good permit. I applied for it twice and I got denied twice.
Well, I guess the hope is not only that it would come back, but actually more that there'd be the return of state park land to indigenous peoples. I think that's
That would be what we'd be calling now. I think the other big thing that we did was before, Native Rangers weren't allowed to have their hair long. And then we made that so they can have their hair long. Yeah. But I think nowadays, returning land to certain tribes would be what the state park should do.
Yes, definitely.
I have a problem. Sometimes they think that it's their land. And actually, they're actually holding it for the people. I don't know what they're doing, but it's not the land. It's, you know, it's whoever's tribe it is. And then we have these tribes, the Hashimun people, the Tongva people, that would love to have a piece of land.
Of course.
A piece of their own land. And
because it belongs to them, I mean, rightfully so.
But, at the very least, make them the managers of that of that park. Make that tribe the manager. And that's I work a lot with Australian Aboriginals, and that's what they're starting to do with the national park.
That's wonderful.
It's put cultural leaders in certain tribes as the leaders in these different parks. To determine how they're run.
I feel that momentum. It's kind of like the 100th monkey effect, because it is happening in little parts around the world. And as it just continues gaining momentum, it is what's happening, because it's what's right. You know, it's kind of what's meant for our times, is that the lands return to the original stewards. That's what's going to bring health back to this planet.
Right now, my cousin, he has this piece of land in Palmer Reservation up in Mount Palomar.
Okay.
And He says he doesn't use any science, but he uses science. He also prays a lot about what he's doing. Mm-hmm. Is he what he should be doing?
Right.
And he's just doing this wonderful job at Palomar, just really opening up meadows and pastures, and you can sit up there and tapping up onto springs and having these pools that run down there. It's just really nice. And you can like see the open area, you can see deer running around.
Oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm. And you can see mountain lions hunting the deer. It's like, it's just so cool.
Uh-huh.
But he's just relying on, to me, genetic memory of how he was supposed to be doing it. Because it was originally my great uncle's land.
Okay.
And then it was my cousin's father. He's my cousin too, but his father, he got attached to that piece of land, started taking care of it, and then he started taking care of it. He goes, and I go, now that mountain has you, mm-hmm. But he goes, yeah, but that's not a bad thing.
Richard, we're going to take another break here, and we want to talk a little bit about you and the Californian Indian Basket Weavers Association. Be right back. Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying Eco Justice Radio. Stay connected by subscribing to Eco Justice Radio on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows and guests and get connected with us on social media. Today, you are listening to Ethnobotany, Cultural Fire, and Indigenous Stewardship with host Carrie Kim and guest Payum Kawish Elder Richard Bugbee, instructor of Ethnobotany and Ethnoecology at Cuyamaca College through Kumeyaay Community College in San Diego County, California. So, Richard, being a member of the California Indian Basket Weavers Association, you know, I wanted to say it saddens me when I hear of the stories like we've talked about with the Tongva and just other Indigenous peoples who may no longer have access to their traditional materials, whether it be for basket weaving or other practices or part of their material culture. And I wonder how you feel that this could change. I know we talk about returning state parks to the Native peoples to whom they really rightfully and ancestrally belong. I don't know if you had any other comments on this.
The hardest part about weaving baskets are hard to weave. But the harder part of weaving the basket is going and gathering the material.
Right.
And prepping the material like a year before you gather it. And knowing where there is some material, because with all this concrete and asphalt, it's getting scarce.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some that grows better than others.
Well, it makes me think about the project that you and Lacey Boyer Cannon done, Indigenous Regeneration, how you did the kind of restored those materials for basket weaving, right?
Yeah. Well, I used to work at the Museum of Man in San Diego. Mm-hmm. Now it's the Museum of Us.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I can always recognize baskets made in San Isabel.
Mm.
And it's because the juncus grow really close to the oaks and the red in the juncus.
Oh, the way it comes out, yeah.
Was redder. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking, there was a bunch of oaks at one farming place. Mm-hmm. And I was going to put berms around the drip lines and then plant juncus in those berms so they get the nice red.
Uh-huh.
And then take that. There's going to be a like a produce stand, but there's a lot of reservations and tribes there, so I was going to put basket juncus and basket weaving material there for tribal members to purchase instead of have to go gather, and we could kind of grow them on the farm like that.
Right.
It was kind of funny because they're planning these things and they go, oh yeah, this has a 30-day turnaround. Or this has a 60-day turnaround. I mean, then the time it goes into something you can eat.
Right.
And so I was planting a black oak, and I go, this has a 60-year turnaround.
Oh my God, that's so funny. Because modern human beings, especially Western human beings, has pretty much largely failed to protect Mother Nature. Do you feel that rights need to or should be established for nature? I mean, I know that that's been a movement that's been happening in several different countries, you know, whether New Zealand, Australia, Colombia, Ecuador, people, you know, Bangladesh, India, they've all had some instances of where they've protected, say, a river as a living entity and different things like this. I mean, what do you feel about that? I mean, obviously, if we were more living as the indigenous peoples did, this wouldn't be necessary. But given that destruction continues to happen, do you think this is something that should be done?
It's something that shouldn't even need to be done.
I agree with you.
But yeah, for people that don't understand, yes.
Like it's a step in the right direction to, I mean, it's like, stop the bleeding and kind of the sense, you know.
I'm saying, when they do these burns, they say, oh, fuel, even though I said fuel, and it's not fuel, they're living beings. Plants are living beings. They just can't run or, but they do think.
Right. And they do speak.
And they do communicate with each other. And they do a lot of things, and they can do a lot of things we can't do.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, 100%. Would you speak about your involvement with land conversation and what land conversation is doing?
I remember I did a willow project with them. We cut down willows and see if they grew better, knocked down or upright. But it was taken over by the wood rats.
Oh.
And they made it a wood rat condominium.
So what did you find? It was better which way?
The willow grew straighter and better. The trees knocked over.
Knocked over. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
You are also a member of the Elder Circle for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And I was wondering, when you were a part of that, what were some of the ways that the Elder Circle was able to influence the service?
well, you know what they brought. Actually, that was when I was kind of younger then. No, I mean, I wasn't. I think I was maybe in my 50s. But that's right when the fish and wildlife people realized that plants had something to do with their fish and wildlife.
Light bulb, right.
And that they should get some advice about. And that's how me and my teacher ended up being on that thing. And I remember my teacher was pretty elderly by the time we were on that council.
Mm-hmm. But are you finding also for yourself and in what you do, are there more people, do you find that there's more people seeking after you for that, for the wisdom that you hold or the plant wisdom that you, the knowledge that you have? Has it changed?
Yeah, there was a time where I kind of stopped teaching but then I thought it wasn't fair to my teacher. That if I stop teaching, then why should you teach me?
Right, there's a break.
I have to teach as many people as I can.
Right, that's just kind of the reciprocity, isn't it? For what?
Yeah, and actually I teach at Kumeyaay Community College there.
Right.
And that gives me a good outlet, and I get to mess with science because, like I said, my other teacher's a scientist.
Yeah, right. But I love what you said about science being trial and error, because it's a good way to look at it, you know, and it's accurate.
Yeah. I mean, that's the way things work with scientific things.
Given the risk of extinction for much of the flora and fauna around the world, whether we're talking in here in California, whether we're talking about the Chinook salmon and up in Washington, the orca whales, to Joshua trees, what message do you wish to impart to the youth of the world?
I think one of the things, when I lived in Australia, one of the things I noticed is they watched the world. and they were saying, save the rainforest. And I go, oh, you care about the rainforest in South America? And they go, no, save our rainforest, you know? Mm-hmm. And because they saw that other rainforest being, and I just see everybody just working together.
Well, I would say that the fate of all peoples is tied together in our times. It's really the only way forward is unity around a much larger cause than ourselves. And I wonder if you feel that traditional ecological knowledge really needs to be shared more widely.
Oh, techies.
Or I don't know, whatever word you would want to say for that.
Yeah, I know. That's what it is. And it's okay because that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know.
Because of the breaks that so many people have had with their ancestral wisdom, because even if we say, oh, all people are indigenous to the land from somewhere, but most people, there's a break in that connection and they no longer know how to grow. They no longer know what are their, the traditions from the plants of their region from where they come from originally.
Yeah, we have a farm next door. Mm-hmm. And I saw this little toddler come through. And she jerked on these green things and pulled out a couple carrots or a carrot. And her mom came by and rinsed it off, and the little kid ate that carrot, you know? And I thought, that kid's gonna always know where food comes from.
Mm.
Because when I worked at the Museum of Man, kids thought meat came from a styrofoam tray with clear plastic over it. And that's where meat came from. They had no idea it was an animal.
Right.
And I taught my little grandkid, he's eating some bacon, and he comes in and goes, Grandpa, I'm eating a cow. I go, well, you're close, it's a pig. And so he turns around, and his older brother's right there. He goes, Ryan, I'm eating a pig. Oh, I said, okay, he got it.
Right. Well, it's true. I mean, given the fact that, so much of our youth these days, they don't cook for themselves. I mean, most of it's like food delivery or something prepackaged. I mean, more so than ever before. And this is global.
Yeah, it's just, kids think that food comes from a grocery store.
Mm-hmm. And they don't know how to grow food, right?
No.
So, I mean, that's that whole part about how we used to live outdoors. Like, that was more of our life. You know, when I think of these makeover shows of something, I'm like, that should actually be shows in nature. There shouldn't be any show about a house and remaking a house. Because it doesn't matter in the end. You know, that's what's not going to save your life in the end, you know, when you don't have food or water or
house. I'm in a little unique. I'm in a concrete house that's embedded into the side of the hill.
Oh.
It's kind of strange.
Did you build it that way?
No, I didn't build it at all. That's where I live in. It's pretty nice. It's like a 2,500 acre front yard.
You know, looking back on your life of learning about plants and traditional life ways, all the things that you've done in your life and seen, what advice would you like to give to modern people? Because they are living in this unprecedented, troubled, but also auspicious time. No, it's not all doom and gloom.
Yeah, it's, you know, I live in this space that I'm kind of back in time where I can, I'm a heroine with nature. And when I visit like I got to go up to UCLA for a couple of days, and I'm kind of, yeah, it's like I got to sit in the city for like 3 days. I don't know if I'm going to be able to handle it. But I lived in Topanga for 25 years, which is not really the city either. But I remember looking into the San Fernando Valley up from Topanga, and just looking at that valley. And erasing all the trees and the houses. I had to erase the trees because most of them are non-native.
Uh-huh.
But it didn't say, oh, I bet your bears roamed over these hills and just kind of put it back.
Yeah. There's a permaculturist that we interviewed on the show, Warren Brush. And one of the things he said is when he comes to the city, he touches concrete and then tells the concrete there, you know, I remember you, river, that this is like a way that helps him to be in the city instead of thinking of it as concrete.
Yeah.
Because it is hard to be in the city for sure. Especially for someone who's lived so close to nature as you have.
And it's so different from, you know, LA's river is a concrete river. San Diego's river is still a regular river. I mean, it's still got willows and cottonwoods.
Oh, I can only imagine. It looks
like a river.
Yeah, like the
Indiana. It's just lined with hotels. That's
all. Oh, gosh, right. Oh, geez, you know. Aside from the obvious of returning native lands to native peoples and seeing more and more of that globally, what would you like to see in your lifetime?
You know, I really think they're going to get the land back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing besides that.
Mm-hmm.
When I used to hang around with the elders, they used to say, when we get the land back, we're going to do this. When we get the land back, we're going to do that. And I thought, they're never going to get the land back. But then I also thought, oh, we need to do fires. Oh, they're never going to let us do fires. But they're starting to let us do fires.
There's things happening, yes, little by little by little, it's happening. And I think the difference is, too, when it's happening globally with Indigenous peoples in various parts of the globe, that makes this exponential momentum in that direction. It is like that 100th monkey effect.
And I think as Indigenous people, we're really feeling our ties to the land and how we're connected to the land.
Yeah. And what do you want to say also about, you know, Indigenous peoples and reconnecting to their native foods? Because that, just as we talk about the language, the same thing is what's going into the body and then making the thoughts and the consciousness. You know, that cycle is so important, you know, given all the devastation around food that was intentional, right? Kind of all the extermination campaigns. What do you say about that part of the food cycle and decolonizing food and the importance of that?
One of the things, I was the editor for, I think it was called Indians of Southern California with the emphasis on the Kumeyaay.
Mm-hmm.
And in this booklet, it said acorns were the main food of the Kumeyaay.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess acorns were the main food. It sounds good to me. And the other elders came down on me and said, why'd you let that pass? I go, it's not our main food? And they go, no. I go, what's our main food? And they go, meat.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, well, here's a food that we go up once, we have it like 2 weeks out the whole year to gather. We mm-hmm. take our whole tribe up to gather it.
Right.
We get enough for the whole year
uh-huh.
to eat every day for every meal.
Right.
And they said, this is not our main food. This is our staple food. Uh-huh. This is like beans or rice or potatoes. Right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I go, what's our main food? They go, meat.
Mm-hmm.
But wild meat is very high in protein,
mm-hmm.
but there's not enough fat in it to maintain your body.
Mm-hmm.
And what is really good fat is the acorn.
So those two
and
things.
The acorn is always eaten with the meat.
Right.
And then I come to realize that our food is all about supplements because we didn't drink milk. And from the time you're weaned from your mom until you're an adult, your bones are really growing. And mm-hmm. so what builds better bones? Powdered bone. We crush up the bones of small animals and put it in our food. And so
would
we
they
knew
the soup, or would they just you know, how would they digest that?
It'd be all in a stew, and everything be eaten in a stew.
Mm-hmm.
Very little food was eaten raw,
right?
And so it was a bunch of nutrients, but mm-hmm. because food wasn't thought up as so much as food as medicine to maintain your body.
Right.
And I think that's probably another reason why we live to be so long.
Richard, could you explain how, you know, how listeners can be in contact with you. And I know you offer a lot of the teaching around cultural programs down where you are on Kumeyaay lands. And if you could just explain a little bit about how, you know, some of your contact info.
Okay. Well, like my email?
Yeah, or however listeners could find out more about you.
Yeah, it's Hunwut, or HUNWUT at AOL.com. I changed that one for a while.
So is that the best way for listeners to contact you, is through that?
Yeah, because if you call me on your phone, off the phone, and I just see numbers, I think you're going to extend my warranty.
You see many phone calls. Richard, thank you so much for all the many years of your devotion to the plants, to your heritage, to reclaiming the language, and then helping others do the same. You truly are a treasure, you know, and truly an elder in that regard, you know, because you're passing it on, and really feel that as a responsibility to future generations. And we thank you for that.
Well, thank you.
Hey, listeners, to check out the extended recording of the show or to explore other shows, subscribe to our podcast or visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org. This has been Eco Justice Radio and our show, Ethnobotany, Cultural Fire, and Indigenous Stewardship. Thank you to our guest, Payumkawish Elder Richard Bugby, and thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at Eco Justice Radio SoCal 350 and Adventures in Waste. If you like what you heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episodes. You have been listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350, created by Mark and JP Morris, executive producer Jack Eit, producer and co-host Jessica Aldridge, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.